This is Audible.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
The edge of quantum physics is pointing us to new realities and greater understanding of how the universe works. This affects all of us, each individual and the whole. The world of science has led us to specialization and has distanced us from the sacred. So it is unusual to discover a scientist who, through his understanding, points to deeper realms. Our guest today, David Bohm, a preeminent scientist, is considered one of the world's foremost theoretical physicists. His book, Causality and Chance in Modern Physics, has become a classic in the field of quantum mechanics and is widely used at universities, as are his books on quantum theory and relativity. For more than two decades, he enjoyed a close association with Jay Krishnamurti, the late world-renowned philosopher sage, and they explored questions of mutual interest together. David Bohm is the author of Wholeness and the Implicate Order, and Science, Order, and Creativity, which he co-authored with physicist David Peet. This is the first of a two-part interview recorded at the Ojai Foundation in Ojai, California. Join us for the next hour as we explore the compelling and breakthrough ideas of physicist David Bohm. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. David, in the book Science, Order, and Creativity, you talked about the fragmentation of science. And could you explain that further, what you mean by the fragmentation of science?
Well, science has been divided into a great many different divisions, parts, you see, say, physics, chemistry, biology, many others, neurophysiology, neurology. Many sciences, and in turn, attempts are made to unite them by making science in between, like physical chemistry, but this becomes another division. And of course, science itself is divided from other activities in life. It's regarded as a branch in itself. So there's a great deal of division of material, which is really one. You see, that's what I'm trying to say, that all originally science was a kind of organized knowledge, which was one area. I mean, it was part of philosophy. It was called natural philosophy in early days in some parts of Europe, and then it got divided up. And there's some advantages to division in the sense that you can focus on certain questions and give more energy to those questions. But at the same time, it leads to a false division in the sense that things that are really connected are now regarded as disconnected, you see, and also a kind of false unification in the sense that the subjects are not as united in themselves as you might think, and their unity really depends on their connection with broader areas. So that this approach leads to a kind of narrowness in the people who are doing any particular thing, so they hardly know what people who are even in close fields are doing. And so, as they say, you get to know more and more about less and less.
Well, we live in a culture and a time when science is almost assumed the proportion of a god, and many people see science as providing answers to some of the major problems we have in the world today. How do you see that?
Yes, well, it's true what you say, that science is taking over the role that religion used to have of giving answers to deeper questions. And this is going on in especially in life sciences, physics, investigating cosmology. The life sciences who hope to explain the origin of life, and the brain sciences and artificial intelligence hope to explain that all too. And eventually you'll have what they call a theory of everything. And this is more or less what religions were trying to give, saying God made everything. That was their theory. So now, I don't think that science can do this. As a matter of fact, I don't think organized religions have been able to do it either properly. And that's why science is now trying to do it. That people, the effort of religion to provide this sort of guide to people has broken down. Science was one of the major factors in breaking it down by making its assumptions implausible. Now, but I don't think that science can really do this because it's always limited. You see, the assumption of a theory of everything is just, you might as well assume it's not true. I don't think you can get it, you see. And you can't get a final theory. I don't think it's the nature of our knowledge. And it's always inquiring and leaves questions open, and it won't... It also has a kind of objectivity which fails to touch the deepest concerns of people, their subjective concerns. You know, what their deeper values are and what they think, what gives life meaning and value and purpose.
There seems to be some kind of a goal or objective in science to find the ultimate answer. Perhaps the unified field theory would be an example of mm-hmm. that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think it will be an ultimate answer. You see, I think however far you go, it's limited, and you'll be able to go further. Now, if you go into the history of this subject, say during the 19th century, many scientists thought they were getting close to the ultimate answer in terms of classical physics. And say Lord Kelvin, one of the leading theoretical physicists of the time, remarked that in a talk that physics was nearly finished. It was only a matter of refinements in the next decimal point, and he advised young people not to go into it. And he said, there are two small clouds on the horizon, the Michelson-Morley experiment and black body radiation. Well, he chose his clouds properly because each led to a revolution, one to relativity and the other to quantum mechanics, which overturned the base. Now, you can hardly say there are no clouds on the horizon today, but people are anticipating that they're going to be very successful in bringing it all together and tying it up. But I think that there's no basis for that. They may succeed in making a unified theory, and then sooner or later it will run into difficulties, and you will have to extend your knowledge in a new way.
There's this idea that the universe was created from a Big Bang. Do you feel that way, that it came from
Well,
a Big
it may
Bang?
Have. You see, we were just talking about Joseph Campbell and mythology. I mean, now Professor Popper, who has done a lot of work on the philosophy of science, has said every theory could be regarded as a kind of myth. It sort of guides our action, and it will work up to a point, right? Eventually myths get outdated. Now, see, the theory does not tell us what is, but it just says if we assume that that is what is, we will be able to handle, we'll understand and put together and handle a large number of area of experience, right? The word theory is based on a root theory in Greek, which has the same, the word theory in Greek, which has the same root as theater, which is to view. See, if you said a theory is a theater of the mind, which gives insight, like if you're watching a drama, you're not giving a literal representation of these characters, but it's giving insight into something else, right? And I think that's the best way to look at a theory. It does not give a literal representation of things as they are.
Cosmologists point to the universe as continuing to expand.
Yes.
And the suggestion is that the universe is changing constantly.
Yes.
So that kind of belies the idea of finding some ultimate answer, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, there are two views. One is to say that there is an ultimate answer, and the other is to say it's constantly changing and evolving, right? And you cannot decide between them. You know, you can maybe say some people favor one or the other. Now, the majority of scientists now favor the idea that it has come from a Big Bang and that it has gradually evolved. And then it raises questions, what was before the Big Bang? But if you ask, are there universal laws that are fixed in there, but where do they come from, you see? If you were religious, you would say God ordained them, which is as good an explanation as any. But Otherwise, you would have to suppose there was something else unknown which determined them, right? Now, or else you say it's just arbitrary, that's the way it is, but then that's no explanation. So I think that comes from, this difficulty comes from the belief that you're going to get a final explanation, rather than saying our theories are abstractions from the unlimited and unknown reality. You see, they're abstract representations of something which is in its depth unknown and even unknowable because it's much too much, right?
You also went to the root of that word, belief.
Yeah.
What is the underneath belief?
Well, the English root is leaf, meaning love. You see, it's the same apparently in German. Somebody, geloben, glauben, right? And it means beloved, right? So that what you believe, the idea that you believe in is beloved, you see. And you really want to defend it and don't like it when people question it and so on, you see.
Is there a difference between belief and believing and know and knowing?
Well, they're shade into each other. You see, there's always an element of belief in all our knowledge because there's no absolute certainty in our knowledge, right? But knowing would aim at something more certain, you see, that in principle it's proved. But I don't think we get absolute certainty. We get a fairly relative certainty, which is good enough for most purposes in a large area. But we can't say with absolute certainty the universe began as a big bang. You see, the cosmology has been changing every 20 or 30 years radically, and it might change again. You see that some people are questioning the Big Bang and saying they have other explanations of the recession of that they say, for example, that light there's a plasma and light is losing it's lowering its frequency by friction, you see. And then there are various anomalies in this redshift, which some people are criticizing. So there's always two views, you see. Now, there's a dominant view and there's another view. For the moment, they're ignoring the other view, but there were two views about things in the 19th century. One was classical physics is right, and the other, a few people were a little dubious. But you can see that out of the second view came something very different. We can't be certain that the general consensus as it is going to continue, you see.
So there really isn't any certainty.
No. See, the quest for certainty is part of the religious motive, right? The religious impetus, right? In religion, many people are looking for certainty. And it's not what I would call true religion, but they would like comfort and security and certainty, you see. Now, since religion doesn't give it, some people are trying to find it in science, right? Saying we have absolute necessity, we really know what's going to happen or what it's all about, right?
Well, there seems to be some almost innate human characteristic of wanting to feel secure.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's related to that in
yes.
some way. Maybe it comes originally from some kind of survival mechanism.
Well, people would naturally like to feel secure about all the things that matter to them. And one of the easiest ways is to assume that it's going to be all right. One of the assumptions was that God would take care of it. But when people couldn't believe that anymore, they went to another assumption. Now, but you see, the modern scientific assumption is psychologically far less satisfying than the old religious one. For example, they imagine this immense universe, which has no meaning whatsoever. It's all mechanical. Everything goes this way and that way, and anything may be destroyed. You know, there's no purpose in it, no values in it, no human beings count for nothing in there. And so it can't really give what people are looking for, even if it were true, right?
You use the word meaning, and you've used it in your work a lot. Could
yeah.
you talk about what meaning is to you?
Yes, well, first of all, the dictionary definition of meaning is it means significance, purpose, and value. Right? And you know, significance is merely what the word points to, as it were, you see, the meaning, right? Now, but there's no meaning without value in the sense that it means a lot to me, it says it has a high value, or I mean to do it, says it's my purpose. Now, purpose and value are connected because you will not have a purpose unless it has a value, right? And ultimately, the significance helps point to the purpose and the value, so they're all related. And see, this question of significance, purpose, and value is very deep concern to everyone. See, without this, I think people will go to pieces, right? In other words, the whole psyche cannot be maintained or organized without it, right? And people are going to seek that wherever they are. Now, I think that this mechanical universe gives very little meaning except to those people who enjoy working it out. They get a lot of meaning and fun. That's a lot of fun for them, perhaps, to work out how it works. But for those who are not engaged in that, it doesn't really, you know, people can say, well, okay, what's the difference? It doesn't make any difference to us at all, right?
There's also this idea of the search for meaning in life.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the search for meaning in life? Do you think there's meaning in life?
Well, the question is, what would that mean? You see, what is its significance, right? And I think people are looking for a sense of value there when they are searching for meaning, right? Value and purpose, right? They would like something felt to be of such high value that it gives them a strong purpose and it makes life really worth living, right?
Perhaps if you're searching for meaning, you can't really live.
No, you can't. It means you don't have... I would say it's a sign that your life lacks value to you, you see. So that's the deeper question. You see, if you begin to search for meaning, it should... If your life had a lot of value to you, you wouldn't... it was worthwhile, you wouldn't be searching for a meaning, right? Now, perhaps because of the way things have developed in society or other reasons, many people may feel, or often even in the distant past, have felt that it lacks value. You see, even in the Bible they say things, you know, like the salt has lost its savor and vanity of vanities. King Solomon said vanity of vanities, all is vanity, right? So this is not a new problem. And the therefore people at a certain stage get a sense that life is not worth anything, you know. And they begin to look. They say, will God give meaning? Will some work give meaning? You know, will some relationship give meaning? And the deeper question is, what is the source of this value? What is the source of the... I would like to say the word value has a root, an interesting root. Its name is valor and valiant. It means strength. Now, so I'd say the primary sense of value is that sense of energy and strength which infuses you. And that would give you the energy to do whatever seems worthwhile to you. Now, therefore, then people may then define their values with words and so on, but the primary value has a source beyond that, I think.
As you've used the word meaning,
yeah,
in your writings, you've also used the term wholeness. And I'd like you to describe what you mean by wholeness.
Well, yes. You see, this is this ties up with the question of fragmentation that we've just discussed, that not only is science fragmented, but the whole of our society and the whole of our life is broken into bits, right? And also each individual has all sorts of bits, which are really... one, right? Now, fragmentation consists of dividing what is one and simultaneously unifying what is not one, right? The two mistakes are the same, right? By, for example, suppose we have the world broken up into nations. Really, it's all one. Everybody is interdependent. The pollution and the radioactivity and everything else crosses the boundaries. The boundaries are just drawn by our ideas, right? But then they become apparently real boundaries because we live accordingly. Now, so we could say that we have made a false division of things that are not really independent and a false unification of what's inside each division, right? Now, when I say that's fragmentation, you see, it means more than just division. It means false division. It has the root of the word fragment, to break, right? To smash up. I give here the image of a watch you have smashed up, which no longer has parts, you see. And now, so the fact that there is parts and there are parts and so on is not always fragmentation, you see. Now, then wholeness is another attitude of saying to start from wholes and see the parts as organically arising in the wholes and related to the wholes. finding the right parts, which are in the right hold, right? Rather than not arbitrarily breaking off bits and calling them parts. So there's an attitude of wholeness to start by being sensitive to a whole, finding out what is the right whole, and finding out what are the real parts. And I think that will lead to a greater harmony in the whole of what you do.
And I want to give you the opportunity in this dialogue we're having to give a description, brief hopefully, but yeah, of your implicate and explicate description of how you think the universe works.
Yes, do you want to do that now?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yes, well, on the basis of quantum mechanics, I was led to this idea of the implicate or enfolded order. Now, the word implicate means enfolded and explicate unfolded. Now, you may think of an image of a piece of paper which you fold up into a tiny bit. You make little cuts, and then you unfold it into a whole pattern. This Japanese art form called origami. Now, that image may perhaps help guide us in what I mean by the implicate order. The idea is that everything is enfolded in everything. You see that that the whole, for example, the whole universe is enfolded in the light which enters your eye. And it unfolds to an image into the brain and your consciousness. I gave some examples in terms of physics, if you'd like them now.
Sure.
The one example was just the holograph, you see. Now, ordinarily a lens makes an image of an object by taking one point, from one point on the object, all the light goes out and is focused to one point on the image. So there's a point-to-point correspondence, approximately, between object and image. That leads you to think of these points as the basic idea, and how they're related. Right? It's a way of breaking. It tends to break things up. Now, in the holograph, the thing goes differently. You have light, which is a wave, and it comes off the object, you know, which is being registered. And it interferes with another part of that same light and forms a very complex pattern of waves which contain information about the whole object in each part of space. You can take a photograph of that and then send similar, I should have said it was laser light to make it easy, very highly coherent and regular. And you send similar light into the plate, and waves will come out similar to the waves that came from the object. So you get a three-dimensional image. But the main point is that every part of this holograph contains information about the whole object. It is not in point-to-point correspondence, right? Now, I say that that's the way light works, as waves go out into the whole universe, and waves from the whole universe enter each region and contain some form information about the whole universe. And now, the idea of the implicate order was to work on that basis, and by looking at quantum mechanics, I could see that that was the basic meaning of the equations, how things are moving, right? For the electrons, for all particles. That what the particle is doing here depends on this whole, right? And it's not merely that it forms an image, but its whole activity depends on the whole, right? That its very being. So that each thing is internally related to the whole and to each part of the universe, right?
Let me give a couple of examples, maybe to simplify it a bit. Would the explicate order be the material world, what we see and what we can feel and touch, and the implicate order be that part that we can't see?
Well, that's true, yes, but it's not merely that it can't be seen. You see, there are many things that can't be seen which still are explicate because maybe they're too small to be seen or too tenuous to be seen or something of that nature, right? But this is not seen, but at the same time, it's not seen in a particular way. It is enfolded, the whole in each part, right?
Let me use another example. Would the implicate order be the same thing, say, as Jung's collective unconscious?
Well, it depends on what he means by that. But you could say, if you could look at it that way, saying, I think many Jungians do.
So what we know, perhaps what we know in our conscious mind might be described as explicate.
Yes.
And what we don't know, our unconscious, might be described as implicate.
Yes, you could say the unconscious is enfolded and it unfolds into explicate patterns. which you're conscious of. But that raises the question in my mind that it might be possible to become somewhat conscious even of the unfolded order by being sensitive to it. But our ordinary mode of consciousness focuses on this explicate order. It's like the lens focuses on it, using a lens, right?
Perhaps the more conscious we become, the more the implicate order or the unconscious becomes available to us.
Yes. You see, that I would like to pursue that a little further, that if we think of our consciousness, its content comes from the whole context, right, in which we live, all the way out to the universe, right? So we say, where is it? You see, it's enfolded in us. We can't see it. But it's actively enfolded because our whole behavior comes from that, right? According to the way we have enfolded the universe, we act, right? So therefore, our being is the result of the whole universe. See, it's in consciousness you get the most direct sense of the implicate order, if you look at it that way.
Well, I think we've all been conditioned and trained, particularly in the West, that somehow the brain is the receptacle of consciousness, and it holds all of our life experience, and when the brain's dead, consciousness is gone. And you're suggesting that's not true.
It need not be true. You see, the brain, there are various views about the brain. One view is the one you just said. The brain is the center of consciousness, and it would put consciousness as a kind of very fine explicate order inside, right? It's all registered in there somehow. as if it were tapes. But even tapes are a kind of implicate order, you see. I mean, the videotape has a certain order which you couldn't recognize the image, and when it goes through the machine, it gets strung out into an explicate order, right?
Yeah.
So, therefore, consciousness, even at that level, it has some implicate order, but the idea would be, one idea is it's all in the ordinary structure of the brain. Now, another view would be to say that the brain may have opened to the whole universe in some way, not merely through the senses, but in some other way. You see, that's a thing you could explore, right?
Some people. So the brain might be a tuning device.
Or, yes, an antenna. It might contain something like an antenna which picks up, is able to pick it up and unfold it, right? See, as the radio does. You see, the radio, the wave comes through the room and very, very weak, and it goes through the antenna, and the whole radio set picks it up and unfolds it into an image, let's say, like the television.
Then you have to have the particular set in order to pick up the particular wave.
Yeah. Well, or else the set must be also not only the right structure, but also not occupied with too many other things, right? If it's holding one program, it can't hold another.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with David Bohm, author of Wholeness in the Implicate Order. We're going to continue our exploration of David Bohm's provocative ideas in 1 minute.
David, I wanted to ask you about the example of Helen Keller that you used in Science, Order, and Creativity, about how she learned from her teacher, Ann Sullivan, speak when she was deaf and supposedly dumb.
Yes, well, as well known, she was unable to see or hear, and therefore she never learned to speak, and at a very early age she had this trouble, and when she was quite young, they got the teacher, Ann Sullivan, to help her. Now, the way she operated was that finally she exposed the child to, she played a kind of game exposing the child to all sorts of objects, touching them and scratching the name of each object. The child evidently didn't know what it meant, regarded it as a game, and for a long time it looked as if she was getting nowhere. But the once, just about when they were almost ready to give up, she exposed her to water, standing still, and scratch the name, and then a bit later, perhaps an hour, I don't know, to water in a tap, running, right, from a pump. and with the same name. And then the child reports that she had an insight suddenly that everything has a name, right? Now, so that radically changed her life, because from there on she was able to go on quickly to learn names and to make sentences and to communicate. And her character changed almost immediately, and her whole life changed, you see. Now, if you ask what happened, that the experience was that water from a pump felt very different from standing water. There was no reason for her to know. With eyes we can see that one could turn into the other, but without eyes, there's no way for her to know that. And she thought they were two different experiences. And the puzzle was, why it was the same thing on her hand, right? And then suddenly she saw that it was one substance, water, in many forms, you know, which could have even more forms, so that she could add to this concept of water, right? See, so the concept of water came through seeing two very different forms and giving it the same name. And the important point was it had a name and could be communicated, right? Now, she may have had concepts before, but they couldn't be communicated. Say, a child who never learned to speak would be able to see water was one substance, but he couldn't talk it over with anybody. You see, it would be very limited. Now, therefore, the name has a tremendous significance, you see, for making all this possible. And the name calls up the whole concept. As she learns more about water, it all is there. And this concept sort of shows how they're all related and so on. Now, see, the name is a kind of explicate form. The concept is implicate, the meaning, right? Not only the way it feels and how they're connected, but what she could do with it and all that. She's learning all that. And then she learns to put these names together and make sentences and so on. Now, and she also had another... Now that notion that everything has a name, that insight, but she had no word for everything and no word for name, right? So it must have been a nonverbal insight into the naming relationship. See, so what could it have been? There must have been some implicate meaning enfolded in consciousness which you can't describe, right? You know, it sort of suddenly acted. And then you gave it a name, which makes it explicate. And then with the aid of the name, you can hold a kind of image. I mean, she didn't have a visual image, but she must have had a feeling image, like how it felt, right? And therefore, the name began to make it explicate, right? The name itself is explicate, and it's also communicable, but then it sets up in the other person something very similar. So therefore, the name is the movement between the explicate and the implicate. And back.
Somehow it reminds me of the Zen story of the group of Buddhists in Japan who decided to hold a conference of all of the great scholars of Zen Buddhism, bring them together for a weekend conference, and they all came together and they spent all weekend talking with one another and dialoguing and monologuing and etc. And that was that. And then the same people decided, though, they'd have a conference of all of the major Zen practitioners, and they brought all of them together, and they spent the weekend nodding and smiling to one another.
Sitting.
And not talking. And in some sense, there was a communication, but it was beyond words. It just brings up the whole idea of that somehow we're communicating at a level beyond words all the time, and then words are really not communicating what we really see or intend in the first place, right?
Well, that may be going wrong, but in the case of Helen Keller, words did communicate. You see, without those words, Helen Keller would have remained a wild animal. She might not have survived very long, right? Therefore, the word was a tremendous insight for her, and the words were communicating, right? Now, perhaps something has gone wrong with our use of language so that they're not communicating, you know, the people who have sight and sound and everything, but somehow not communication, right?
Yeah, that perhaps Helen Keller's handicap, if you want to call it that, allowed her to treat words very differently than someone who didn't have that handicap to deal with words.
Yes, I think it may. She had to take them much more seriously, and you know, because she depended on them, and her whole relationship was through that. You know, now because she couldn't see and she couldn't hear, so there was no other way, right? And she eventually became very skilled in the use of words. I mean, she wrote and you know, very nicely, and she passed the university course. And she obviously had a very good intelligence, but still the teacher also saw the point. You know, the key point was the connection between the one common name and the different experiences, you see. Now, which makes a concept, because if you only... there was a case of a wild boy they found in France, you may have seen the film, where he was about 9 or 10 years old, and he couldn't talk because he had been raised in the wild somehow, perhaps, I don't know how. And he had no communication, you know, through words, and there was the man who... I see, all the people in this village just simply were very cruel to him and made fun of him, but this man took him in and tried to teach him language. He was a sort of an educated man, and he had a whole thing on a board on his wall, all sorts of hammers, pitchers, you know, all sorts of things. And he repeated the name and tried to get the boy to repeat the name, you see. And the boy never learned language, and he died a few years later, you see. That perhaps the trouble was he was a bit too old, that's one explanation. But there was one point I noticed in the film, that when he looked at water, the boy got very excited, and the man didn't notice that, you see. You see, perhaps if he had started working with water, it would have been the way in. You see that the man was going about it entirely wrongly, because he was naming particular objects. He wasn't treating the fact that the name is the name of a general concept, like water. Therefore, the boy might have thought, that's the name of this hammer, you see. Like, so-and-so is your name, and this is my name, and this is the hammer's name. He never got the idea of all hammers, right? And he's saying, well, maybe another hammer would be called Mr. or something else, you see. So the point is then that without language, you know, a great deal of what is human would not be possible. In fact, we, you know, but at the same time, language is the means by which all sorts of things go wrong. You know, that's the same as our technology, which has great achievements and has produced very great dangers.
So earlier you're suggesting that our brain and our consciousness is affected by everything in the universe, and so this means in some way that our consciousness must be in contact with the rest of the universe.
Well, that may be. You see, we haven't proved it. Some people feel it. It's quite, from the point of view of my suggestion of the implicate order, it's quite possible, you see, that we have a contact with the universe which is deeper than the senses, you see. As we have a certain contact through the senses, which also involves the implicate order, and then it may be a deeper contact, which we are ignoring now because the ordinary content is filling the brain, you see. There was a case of, say, these computer viruses they recently talked about. Now, they spread the activity to all the computers. Now, what they do is they occupy the computer so thoroughly it can't respond to the keyboard, right? So the point is that if our brain is occupied with all sorts of ordinary things, then it will not respond to this other level, right? That's the make that suggestion. Now, therefore, our ordinary way of life would be against being sensitive to that.
In your book that you co-authored with David Peet, Science, Order, and Creativity, towards the end of that book, you got into the idea of dialogue as a source of creativity. And I want to talk about that and why you feel dialogue is important. Could you just give us a description of what you see as open dialogue, the spirit of free dialogue?
Yes, well, I mean, that the first point is, you know, the very word dialogue means, has a root, Greek root, dia, and logos. Now, logos is the word, and dia means through, not to, but through. A dialogue can be with as many people as you like, not just two, right? And the... And it means, what logos, I say, means refers to the meaning, right? So you get a picture of meaning flowing through or between people. Now, rather than an exchange, you see. Now, the word discussion has an interesting root. It's the same as percussion, concussion. It means, you get the picture of a ping-pong ball being batted back and forth, or perhaps several of them, if there's a large group. And the... idea then is that there people are trying to make points to win, to persuade or to convince, to win, right? to defend their points of view and so on, right? Perhaps to learn a little bit from the other person to strengthen your own point of view. But now this is contrasted with what I regard as dialogue, where if something we don't want, nobody is trying to win or trying to make his point, right? But we are, if anybody wins, everybody wins, right? You see, as if we get some point clarified, then it's everybody wins, right? It's everybody gains. So the point about a dialogue is, first of all, that it, that we have this free flow. Now, you'll discover that because of our whole cultural background, this is not so easy to achieve. People feel uneasy with each other. They resist. This wish to defend your point of view is very strong, right? It's unconscious. And it comes out by people's immediate reactions. They tend to go into this discussion frame, right? Now, so the first point about dialogue is to notice that you can't just have it by will, by choosing to have it, right? It will not just come, you see. Now, you must be your deep intention to have one, but there are going to be things in the way. Now, the first thing in the way is that each person's opinion tends to be defended automatically, you see. Each person feels his opinion is right, the other person is wrong, he's a threat, and so on. You see, now, you can begin by saying we see the necessity of suspending, that is, holding back and holding in front of us our own views, as well as the views of others. As we don't carry out the action immediately, we are not committed to it. You see, we don't necessarily believe it. We suspend belief if we can, right? Saying we're going to look at it. But most of our opinions, we believe them, right? You see, they're beloved, as we were saying. It's hard to do that. Now, but if people are serious and see the importance of a dialogue, then there will be a possibility of suspending this by each person. Now, if that is possible, then something new can come about, you know, where everybody is looking at the whole thing all at once. Both out, it's visible in the group outwardly and what is going on and inwardly. And this will make possible a different kind of communication.
Let's say if we had this form of dialogue that you were talking about in the field of science, what would it look like?
Yes, well, see, let's say sometimes we do to a small extent, you see, but when people forget their own special positions or why they must defend or they must assert their views or whatever, you see. But, well, it would simply mean that people would talk freely for the sake of learning together, you see, of thinking together and learning together and saying we don't know what's going to come out of it. We're not trying, we don't bring our views in there for the sake of making them win or for the sake of strengthening them, but really just to inquire.
So it would mean people would have to give up attaching to a particular position.
Yes, you will hold your position, but you can suspend it. You see, you may say, I prefer this position, but I'm able to suspend it and listen to the other. And I'm not trying to make any position win. I'm looking at them all together, right? Now, out of that may appear some new movement, which is in another direction. That would be creative.
So this is the connection of dialogue to creativity.
Yes. You see that... dialogue would be a way of participating, people participating creatively in common, right? Now, you see, if you don't have dialogue, I don't think meetings between people are going to be creative. They're going to be just attempts to make one view prevail. In other words, they tend to fix the view.
So in some way, those people who are listening to the dialogue that we're having now are carrying on the dialogue in their own way and will take the ideas that you're expressing that we're listening to and integrate them in their own consciousness and move out into the world with whatever they do. Is that right?
I think the word participate is useful here. That it has two meanings. One is to partake of, and the other is to take part in, you see. Now, those who are listening cannot take part in our discussion, but they can partake of it, or they can take part in so far as they go with other people, right? Or else they think it over and so on, right? So Therefore, in a true dialogue, everybody is partaking of the whole flow of meaning and also taking part in it, adding, you know, doing his bit and building, helping to keep it going. Now, with that part, spirit of participation, you could call, you know, kind of a spirit of impersonal fellowship, right? Which, if people get to go on with it, it will become friendship, right?
This also implies a new, certainly an expanded dimension of listening, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, it means listening in this participatory way, saying, well, I'm listening. See, when you listen, you're paying attention to certain things according to your background as to what's important, right? Your values. Huh? Now, therefore, you can't listen to the whole thing because you say the important thing is I've got to protect this idea, I've got to convince, I've got to listen to what would help me do that. Right? Now, in the spirit of the dialogue of thinking together, then we can listen. We have an unrestricted attention. We can listen without those restrictions if we manage to achieve it.
I think of the way that frequently interviews in the media are done, journalistic interviews, that kind of thing, where there's almost a confrontational aspect, and there's some sense almost an aggression that takes place, particularly in investigative journalism, where the journalist is coming with the thought that they're to find something, and so there's a whole intention that comes with the questioning, with the interview. That's not the kind of dialogue you're talking about,
no,
is it?
No, I could call that the adversarial approach, which is very common in our society. Now, that is not really aimed at truth. You see, you can't get at the truth unless you find out what everybody means first. You see, if people are at cross purposes and don't mean the same thing, there will be no point in discussing truth. Now, these people are out to expose somebody or to make their points or whatever, and it's not dialogue. And that I don't think they can arrive at truth that way, you see, that there's going to be a distortion.
Well, there's the idea of asking hard questions, and the hard question is one that essentially comes with a lot of energy and is almost an attack in some ways, and frequently puts the person on the other end of it in a defensive position, feeling they have to defend what they're saying or...
Yes, well, it's not, that's not the approach of dialogue to put anybody on the defensive, but you see, also with the, from the point of view of interviewing, it wouldn't be a dialogue because only if we're both participating. You see, if we are going to be that attacking and defensive, then the person who's interviewed should be able to do the same with the interviewer.
Yes.
But even then, that wouldn't be any good, right? Now, you know, not really.
Because in some sense, you're just dealing with the past there.
Yeah. You see, the interviewer's got a fixed idea about what should be done there and what should be asked, and he has a framework, and he tries to push that person into that framework, and rather, if the interviewer would be sensitively probing and finding out what this is all about, and that would be far better. Now, that he hasn't made up his mind beforehand.
So the idea of allowing this free dialogue allows creativity to emerge. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You see, if you have this fixed position, then that's contrary to creativity. It makes a limit on what you can do. Right. You can't be creative if you hold a fixed position and can't get out of it. Because being creative may just consist of discovering something different, you see. say that perhaps when the interview is over, both people will have learned something they didn't know before.
That's the positive objective of dialogue.
Yes. And at the same, or perhaps the two together, the higher objective would be the two together have created some new understanding which wasn't there before, right? Which they share, right?
And as you suggested, dialogue can include many more than two people.
Yes. In fact, and there's I think that it should, you see, that it's important to have dialogues among a large number of people. 20 to 40, you see, where if you get beyond that, it's very hard to do. But see, with small numbers of people, you get too easily to a point of just simply people adjusting it. They adapt to each other and avoid the points where they disagree in order to be friendly, in order to not have trouble. Or they may, you see, so it seems all very cozy after a while. Now, see, that's also not a dialogue for people to avoid troublesome points. In a larger group, it's almost impossible to keep this going, you see, it will come out. Now, then that's the crucial point, what will happen. You see, one point is, it may be so disturbing, somebody would give it up, but assuming they see the importance of the dialogue, they go on with it. Now, if two people come up with two views which are very different and each one is emotionally committed, then you have a crisis, right? Or two groups. Often it turns out to be two subgroups. People are in two subcultures. See, for example, we had a dialogue in Sweden last summer, and it turned out that one group started talking about love. They were sort of a New Age group, and they were very happy talking about love all the time. But there were other people in there, another group which kept quiet, and it was not visible that they were not going along. But in the next hour, they started to talk. They sort of got into an exchange with each other, and see, they gradually began to talk to each other. I wouldn't say there was time to clear it all up, because it really should go on longer, but they began to get a sort of a feeling for each other, and I think a different spirit emerged. And had we been able to go on with it, we might have gone beyond those simple positions of either being sentimental, saying everything is wonderful, love one another, or else, you know, being very skeptical and so on, and very hard-headed. And I think there could have been a creative new move, you see, which would have had a lot of significance. You see, the point is that dialogue, in that sense, brings about frustration, right? Now, one response to frustration is, I'll just give up, right? But, you see, that's one of the mistakes people make. It's crucial, you know, not to give up if this is important, right? Now, because now, if people will keep at it, you see, in spite of frustration, you see, now there are various cultural factors that are in the way. You see, one of our cultural features of our culture is that people would get together for one or two reasons to talk. One would be to entertainment and pleasure, or the other would be to do something useful, right? Now, this dialogue is accomplishing neither, you see. Then people begin to feel frustrated. What are we doing here? We're neither enjoying it nor are we accomplishing anything useful. Now, if you can stay with that frustration, you will see that something much deeper is involved, which is we have got to learn to share meaning. If we don't do this, we will never get together. We will never understand each other. We will never find truth. We will never be creative. And all the rest that we do will have no point, right? Because the whole of technology has no point if people can't share what it means, right?
I've been speaking with David Bohm, world-renowned physicist and author of Wholeness in the Implicate Order, and co-author of Science, Order, and Creativity. In the next interview with David Bohm, we'll continue our exploration of the dialogue process and how to share meaning with one another. Also, how J. Krishnamurti influenced David Bohm's work, the limitations of thought and the possibilities of thinking, and the nature of objective reality, as well as a great deal more. That's in the next interview with David Bohm. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of the New Dimensions radio staff and all those who are members of Friends of New Dimensions, I'm wishing you well.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.